I was 16 years old when my grandmother passed away. We called her Mama. That's a Southern style name for grandmother. And now that's what my children call my mother. And I loved my Mama dearly. We used to live in Connecticut. She lived in Louisiana, and she would visit us and always bring two suitcases. One with her clothes and whatnot, and one with stuff from Louisiana you couldn't get in Connecticut. So there'd be pecans and strawberries. I'm not sure to this day how she flew with strawberries, but she would. Barbecue sauce. You know, there was no Amazon, so she'd have to import from Louisiana all the stuff we could get to Connecticut. Later in her life, she had a stroke. She ended up in an assisted living environment. I had the privilege of visiting her a few weeks before she passed away. And I was the one that answered the phone call to hear that she had died. It's weird to say it, and I'm still a bit ashamed of it. But as a 16-year-old, I got that call that my grandmother had died, and I couldn't stop smiling. I wasn't happy. It wasn't like a Christian, I was happy for the resurrection thing. I loved my mama, and I was going to miss her, but I think I didn't know what to do with that emotion. And so I had this weird grin, and I remember just feeling terrible about it, feeling like I was somehow dishonoring her. You know, in the movies, somebody gets the phone call, and they just fall apart in tears, sobbing, and that didn't happen. So I didn't know what to do. I thought something was wrong with me. Why would I be smiling when my grandmother died? How do we deal with death? How do we grieve? What does it really look like? Is it like it is in the movies? Does it follow a pattern? Are we supposed to grieve in a certain way? And what does following Jesus have to do with it? Does that change anything? Does that give us a new kind of response? This morning, as Rob mentioned, we're concluding our series in Lent called The Final Hours. We started 7 weeks ago with the meal that Jesus shared the night before he was betrayed. We've tracked the last 18 hours of his life, the arrest, the betrayal, all those things. And last week, we saw Jesus die. This morning, we're in this weird time frame in between the death and resurrection of Jesus. And as we stay there, we're going to see three different responses to the death of Jesus. We're going to see how the people around Jesus were dealing with death. Now, most years, we think about Jesus dying on Good Friday, and then we celebrate the resurrection on Sunday. But this year, because of our series, we've kind of elongated that process. You could almost think of last Sunday as Good Friday. We saw Jesus on the cross. We thought about his love for us that kept him on the cross. We thought about God's love for us that left Jesus on the cross. And we stayed there with the death of Jesus. Next Sunday is Easter, and we'll celebrate the resurrection. But you could think about this Sunday as that Holy Saturday, in between Friday and Sunday. It turns out that something important happens on Saturday. We'll see some familiar characters this morning. We're going to start off with Joseph and Mary, but not the Joseph and Mary that you think. We're going to see some priests and some Pharisees, and we're going to see how three different categories of people respond to Jesus. Two powerful men making requests and taking action, and two quiet women sitting in silence. Each of these will show us a different way of dealing with death. And as we walk through their stories, I'm hoping that we can discover something for ourselves, that we can learn how to deal with death. And maybe we'll recognize some of the ways, good and bad, that we tend to process death. And then we'll see that the death of Jesus opens something up for us, a different way of handling death. See, Christians ought to be the most skilled at handling death and pain. We have this story that gives us something to draw from, but unfortunately, it's sometimes the case that Christians don't always do it that well, that we're afraid of pain, that we don't know what to do with death, that we jump too quickly to the good news. Sometimes we're afraid of Saturday. So this morning, we're going to spend some time there and think about what we can learn about dealing with death, and along the way, something about living life. So our story begins immediately after the death of Jesus. The first scene shows one powerful man making a request of another. This is Matthew 27, and I'm going to read verses 57 through 60. If you want to follow along, I think it's on page 835 in the Bibles in your pews. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and he asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. We don't really know who Joseph was. People debate about the location of Arimathea. It doesn't really seem to be a prominent place. But Joseph was rich. He was powerful. He had enough clout to approach Pilate one-on-one and make a request of him. He's important enough to be mentioned in all four gospel accounts. But he's a bit of a mystery character. He was part of the council that sought to have Jesus executed. We learn that from some of the other gospels, and we can assume that he sat there with his colleagues deciding for Jesus to die. And either he didn't or couldn't do anything about it. But then after Jesus is dead, he chooses to do something about it. He goes to Pilate and he makes this request. Pilate immediately agrees. In fact, it says he ordered the body to be given to Joseph. That word will be significant later. Joseph makes a request, Pilate gives his response, and then we see the results. That same pattern will play out in our next story. And what we see is this slow motion play-by-play event of the burial. See all the details. Listen to this. Joseph took the body. He wrapped it in a cloth. He laid it in his own tomb, which he had cut out of a rock. He rolled the stone in front of it. He walked away. Every little action is spelled out. Last year, I built an outdoor table out of some reclaimed redwood that I got off Craigslist. It's old wood. It was a huge project because I had to cut off the sides of the wood. I had to plane off the top. I had to sand it down. I had to cut it to fit. I had to assemble it and stain it and apply protector step by step by step because I cared about this process. I wanted it to come out right. I also promise this won't be the last time you hear about this table because I spent a lot of time on it. So I expect to get a lot of sermon illustrations out of it. So be prepared. You'll hear about the table again. But this kind of step-by-step thing is what we see Joseph doing with the body of Jesus. He takes great care. And by doing so, he honors Jesus. He honors the death of Jesus by the way that he approaches his burial. That's something we can learn from. If we want to honor Christ, we honor death. We have to learn to honor death. Now, for the most part, we kind of understand this. Funerals are serious affairs. We wear black and we speak in quiet tones, and we know that there's something different when someone has died. That's why Joseph acts like this. His actions proclaim that death is real. Jesus has really died. This is something to take note of, to treat differently than the rest of life. This is not a game. Growing up, I used to watch the old Batman show. You know, not the new cool ones, but the ones with Adam West. And used to watch the episodes, and basically every episode was exactly the same, right? You know, there's some problem. Batman tries to solve it. He gets himself into this crazy situation that there's no way he can escape from, and then somehow he does, and he saves the day along the way, right? It's basically the episode synopsis. So I remember one where Batman was trying to save the day, and of course he got caught by the bad guy, and the bad guy wrapped him up in chains and dangled him over a boiling pot of acid, and then he was going to drop him in the acid, so the bad guy, you know, flips a switch that slowly lowers Batman into the acid, and then the bad guy walks out of the room. And I'm thinking, why are you walking out of the room? Like, this is Batman. Can't you spare 1 minute to stay and make sure he actually goes in the acid? But no, you know, he walks out of the room. Stupid bad guys. And then, of course, Batman finds some way to loose the chains and somersault over with the switch and captures the bad guy and whatever, and everything's great. But this story, the one we're looking at here, is different. Imagine if Batman didn't escape. Imagine if he was lowered into the acid and he died, and then you see the bad guy driving off with the money and the credits roll and the series is over. They wouldn't do that because they need to make money, right? Batman can't die. But this is what's happened to Jesus. There's a big problem. He rushes in. He's going to save the day. He gets himself caught in a situation that there's no way he can escape from. And he doesn't. He's healed other people. He's raised other people from death. But Jesus dies. And Joseph buries the body. Joseph saw this man that he had staked his hopes on, that he was a disciple of. He saw this man and he saw those hopes die. He saw them fade away. He put the humiliated body of this failed Messiah into his own family tomb. He suffered himself because of Jesus' death. Now, pain and death generally make us uncomfortable. We like to escape from them. We like to move on. We like to go on to the next thing. We don't want to stay there. We don't want to pay attention to them. We want to do something to pretend that nothing has happened. We think if we can just ignore it, then everything will be better. We like to think that that stuff from our childhood, it can just go undealt with. We like to think that those problems in our marriage, they'll probably go away next week. We like to think that, that tendency I have to get angry or to do this or to act in a way, well, I'll probably grow out of it. We tend to think that that pain that I feel, that hurt inside, it's going to fade if I just ignore it. But that's not true. Those things don't fix themselves. We do this to ourselves. We do this to each other. And that's not honoring death and pain. You don't just move on. You don't just go on to the next thing. Joseph stops, takes actions slowly to honor the fact that something terrible has happened. He could have kept going. He's on the council. He could have said, well, you know, my friends were probably right. Jesus was probably a phony. I'll just keep going with life. But he doesn't do that. He takes it seriously. He honors death. So Joseph sacrifices his own tomb for the sake of Jesus. And then we hear about two other characters looking on. Verse 61, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there sitting opposite the tomb. In contrast to Joseph, we know these two women pretty well. We've heard about Mary Magdalene before. The other Mary is almost certainly Mary, the mother of James and John. We just heard about them a few verses prior where they were at the cross when Jesus died. And now they were devastated. that Jesus was dead. They sat at the tomb in silence. It's all we hear about them. You know, there is no indication in any of the Gospels that a single one of Jesus' disciples believed him when he said that he would rise from the dead. In the Gospel of Matthew, which we're in right now, we have three very clear predictions that Jesus makes, saying, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to die, and I will come back in 3 days. Three times Jesus says that in the book of Matthew. We'll see later that even his enemies knew of this prediction. But there's no indication that a single one of his followers believed him. Nobody was here on this day saying, it's fine, he's dead, but he's going to be okay tomorrow. Nobody, when he rose, said, see, I told you, here he is, he's back. Everybody was devastated. Everybody was surprised at his resurrection. Jesus told them he would rise, and no one believed him. As far as we can tell, Joseph was burying a body that he fully assumed would stay dead forever. And those women were sitting at a tomb, believing that this whole thing was over and done. The mission of Jesus had failed. Sit there for a moment. Sit there with those women. Stay in that place. Batman was lowered into the acid. Jesus died on the cross. See the tomb from the eyes of Mary Magdalene, who had seven demons taken out of her from this man, and now she sits thinking that it's over. Mary, the mother of James and John, who had staked the futures of her sons and her own life on the hopes that this man would be somebody. But now he's dead. Everything had fallen apart. We need to read this story and stay there for a moment. We need to sit in that place. Now, we know how it ends. We know that Jesus will rise in 3 days, but they didn't. Can we be there with them? Some of you are not comfortable with this. Some of you don't like this. You want to say, yeah, I know he's dead, but he's going to rise. Some of you are already planning on coming up to the service afterwards and talking to me and saying, you know, you really need to focus on the resurrection here because we want to jump there. We want to remember that, but this day is important. The resurrection means nothing without the crucifixion. We can't celebrate if we don't grieve. We have to cry over the death of Jesus if we're going to dance at his resurrection. We need to learn to grieve. Have you ever been going through something difficult and you've shared it with someone and they say something very, 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 very helpful, like, well, it could be worse. And you think, oh, thank you, you're right. I feel so much better. Or I'm sure God has a plan. And you say, oh, I forgot about God having a plan. Thank you. I'm great now, right? See, we tend to kind of have these trite answers, these easy solutions to very painful things. I was a Boy Scout growing up, and I used to receive this magazine called Boy's Life. I think it's still being published. And I remember there's always this ad in Boy's Life to build your own hovercraft. Now, you could like buy an old vacuum cleaner, and somehow you put some stuff around it, and you build the hovercraft. Now, I never actually did. And I'm sure if it worked at all, it was like a centimeter off the ground. But I had visions of building a hovercraft and hovering to school on it. And what I thought is I'd go and I'd park it on the roof, because why not, right? I could hover. And I don't know how I'd get down from the roof. But that was kind of my big plan in elementary school. And I think about that, and I think sometimes we assume that's how we're supposed to live life. That we're supposed to kind of hover above the difficult stuff of life. That we have this little pocket of insulated air that kind of protects us from anything that's really messy. And we can just kind of skim above the surface, and everything will be fine. But if you remember one thing from this morning, remember that Jesus did not have a hovercraft. Jesus did not have a hovercraft. Jesus entered into the brokenness of life. We sometimes think that we can just right above it, but that's a terrible understanding of the scriptures. Jesus went off by himself in frustration. He raged in anger. He brooded in silence. He wept for the state of the world. He felt the betrayal of his friends and cried in anguish at the abandonment by his father. Jesus didn't have a hovercraft. He grieved. He felt those things. He dealt with pain. A few weeks ago, our women had a retreat on the topic of forgiveness. And Corey Gustafson, our women's pastor, preached a message about lamenting, about learning how to express our pain to God. She was kind enough to let me listen to it, and it was really, really helpful. And she was moved to do that because she sees the same thing I see, that we need to learn this. We need to learn skills of how to express our pain and grief. The reason we need to do that is because that grief becomes an invitation. The pain we feel can open us up to what God is doing. When we allow ourselves to go to that place that we desperately want to avoid, God does something there. He works there. He starts to heal us. He starts to give us something new. Some of us have a lot to learn from the members of our recovery community. A lot of them have learned this lesson a long time ago. The path of recovery forces you to face the pain, to face the death in your life, to work through it, to ask God to work in it. Listen to this quote from a woman who lost two children and coped with the pain for years by an eating disorder. She says, "Yet I don't mind the grief anymore. It is a sign of endless love and a richness, undying hope. I'm learning that grief is part of the beautiful mess that is life. It's part of aching, mending, and becoming whole again when part of you is gone." That's what God does. That's redemption, becoming whole again. But you can't be whole if you don't admit that you've been broken. Grief is part of the process of becoming whole again. There's no redemption without pain. And if we try to jump that over that, if we try to skip that step, we'll find ourselves doing exactly what the next people in our story are doing. The story now jumps to the next day. This would have been the Sabbath day for Jews, a day when you're supposed to stop working and rest. You're not supposed to call councils. You're not supposed to meet with people. You're certainly not supposed to plan an evil plot against the Savior of the world on the Sabbath. But that's what these people do. Listen to verses 62 to 66. "The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, 'Sir, we remember how that imposter said while he was still alive, after 3 days, I will rise again. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he's risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first.' Pilate said to them, 'You have a guard of soldiers. Go, make it as secure as you can.' So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Everyone had heard Jesus' prediction that he was going to rise from the dead. Everyone knew he would be executed. And I kind of imagine the priests after the crucifixion going to bed and thinking, 'Yes, we killed Jesus.' And then somebody wakes up going, 'Oh no, there's that prediction. This is going to ruin everything.' So they scramble and they call everybody together and they go to Pilate and they ask him to post Roman soldiers and they say, 'This might happen and we have to prevent it from happening. This would be worse than the whole thing that he did before this. Please, Pilate, help us. You got to help us fix this problem.' And just like Joseph, they make a request of Pilate. And just like the last story, Pilate responds, but Pilate doesn't order anything to be done. They ask him to order something. Pilate doesn't. Pilate says, 'Come on, the guy's dead. You've won. Get over it. Go post your own soldiers. I'm done dealing with you. See, these priests and these Pharisees, they're pictured as desperate, as frantic, paranoid. They're just scrambling around trying to fix this problem because they don't want to deal with what might happen. They're frantically trying their best to manipulate the situation around them to protect their own self-interests. Just like us. Don't we do that? Don't we go to great lengths to avoid pain? A friend of mine in college told me this story that she used to love rollerblading. And as a kid, her mom would always tell her, you have to wear your wrist guards when you rollerblade. You know what those are? Like those like metal things and you strap them on so that if you fall, you don't break your wrists, right? So she would always wear her wrist guards. She was always very careful to wear her wrist guards. But one day, she forgot to wear her wrist guards. She was out rollerblading and she hit a rock or something and she started to fall forward and like you do, you kind of put your hands out to catch yourself. And then she remembered, I don't have my wrist guards on. So what'd she do? She pulled back her hands so she wouldn't break her wrists and fell face forward on the concrete, gravel and rocks pressed into her face. Sometimes when we try to avoid pain, we make it worse. We do things that don't end up helping at all. Jesus is dead. The disciples aren't planning to steal the body. The disciples are devastated. They're scattered. They've run off. The Pharisees are overreacting. But still the priests scramble, frantically trying to control the situation. Do you recognize that feeling? Have you felt it yourself? That overwhelming desire to control something that you fear might happen. I can't let this happen. If I don't get this job, what am I going to do? If I don't get pregnant, I won't be able to deal with it. If this person gets sick, how could I go on? If this relationship doesn't work or this thing doesn't work out, or if that happens, if that thing that I'm terrified of happening, if that happens, I won't be able to handle it. So I manage it. I control the situation. I go into overdrive mode. We control. We make things tight so that things don't happen like we fear. Can we avoid this? Can we try not to manage the pain around us? Can we grow in that? Don't manage your pain. Don't manage pain. Now, I'll throw in a caveat that there are some situations that you will need to escape. That there are some times when somebody is hurting you or abusing you. And sometimes in the Christian setting, we can kind of say, you need to face into hard stuff, and that can lead to some harder stuff. So if you're wondering, you know, what's going on here, talk to somebody. Sometimes outside perspective can really help. But for a lot of us, we need to let go of this driving control to manage the pain in our lives. The priests and the Pharisees were afraid that the disciples will tell people, he has risen from the dead. And that's an interesting phrase because that exact phrase shows up several verses later when the angel in the empty tomb says to those same two women, go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. That was the phrase that proclaimed the good news. That was the phrase that formed the early church. That was the phrase that became the proclamation of the gospel. And next week, someone will say he is risen, and you will say he is risen indeed. We will say those words to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. So there's a little bit of irony here that the exact thing that the priests and Pharisees were afraid of, the very phrase that they felt like they couldn't handle, that's what happened. The worst that they could imagine was what they had to face. And we're convinced that if the worst happens in our lives, that we won't be able to face it. That there will be no way out of that pain. That we have to avoid it because if we face it, we might get sucked down into the pit and we might never escape. How do we do that? How do we stop managing our pain? How do we have the courage to go there? Well, this is where we remember the rest of the story. This is where we remember that it is Saturday, but Sunday is coming. We might not be able to handle it, but our God can. Our God has demonstrated that even when the worst possible thing happens, He can make something good of it. He can bring life from death. We might be living in Saturday, but Sunday is coming. When we put our faith in Jesus, you know that whatever death you fear and whatever pain you're facing, you know that that is not the end of the story. You have hope that there is something else, that your God has written an end to your story that does not end with pain and death, but ends with life and freedom and joy. And you might not be there yet, but you know it's coming. And what that does is it gives you the freedom to feel that pain. You can grieve. You don't have to skip over it. You don't have to ignore it. You can grieve for real because you know that that grief won't swallow you up. You know that that grief is not the end. You know that you have hope. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4:13, he says, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope." He doesn't say you may not grieve. He says you don't grieve in the way that people who have no hope grieve. We grieve. In fact, we grieve better than anyone because we grieve with hope. We can face it because we know God works through it. Do you know that? Do you believe in Jesus? Maybe some of you don't. And maybe you want that hope. Maybe you want to be able to face pain because there is hard stuff in your life, but you don't know that you have hope because of Jesus. If that's the case, talk to me after the service. Talk to Rob. We'd love for you to know Jesus. We'll baptize you next week on Easter. This could be a turning point for you. Come to the one who brings life from your death. We aren't born knowing how to grieve. When I was 16, I didn't know what to do with the news that my mama had passed away. I didn't know what I should feel. And I was ashamed that I couldn't process that. Grief is a skill. It's something that we learn, that God teaches us. And we can teach each other. This morning, we've seen three different examples. We've seen the powerful Joseph of Arimathea take action. He sacrifices his own tomb. He sacrifices his reputation. He does so to declare something terrible has happened. Life will never be the same. On the other hand, we see the powerful priests and Pharisees take action, trying to control, trying to make sure that the worst doesn't happen, scrambling to protect themselves. And in the middle, we see two women grieving quietly at the tomb. Can you find yourself somewhere in there? Do you resonate with one of those characters? What do you do with your pain? Do you have the hope of Jesus? Christians ought to be the most equipped of anyone to handle the pain and death in this world. We can face it. We can go there. We can cry. We can weep and we can suffer because we know the hope of Jesus. We can sit at that tomb. In fact, we can go there willingly. We can put ourselves into suffering because we know that there's something on the other side. Deal with death. Stay at the tomb. It's not Easter yet, but Easter is coming. Amen.